diplomatically leading man, I presume, but you started out more or less as a character actor, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you find this frustrating that you weren't getting the Tyrone Power roles or that type thing?
No, because I was described, you're absolutely right. I signed at Paramount many years ago in 1946 as a young kid, and I was a character actor then, and I was described as a character juvenile. And that kind of set the tone for me. And my heroes had always been people like Van Heflin and Arthur Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
And those people. And so I more or less set my way to that. And I never aspired to be a leading man because I never thought that I had the qualities, frankly, that women could see, you know, there.
Well, haven't you gotten mice notes from your fans over
yes,
the years?
Yes, I'm very quietly enthused about that.
What's the most violently passionate note you've ever received from one of your admirers? What would you have? Well, I mean, if you can answer.
And could we have her phone number?
It really, well, it wasn't so violent, but I received a letter several years ago. Unfortunately, a lot of mail comes to my house, and Carolyn, my wife, opens it many times, and she'll say, you should read this, you know, it's interesting. And she picked up the mail and opened this letter, and she said, I think you'll find this quite interesting, and handed it to me, and it was a picture of a very gorgeous gal sitting on the floor with a towel lightly wrapped around her. And what she had proposed, she was moving to Canada. And she had laid it out to me very explicitly that it would be a very discreet affair and that I could meet her at her apartment or any place that I suggested. And the phone number and the address was there. And I, after reading it, I looked at Carolyn and I said, if it's all right with you. But you manage, it, you know, it makes you feel like when I get a mash note, I feel, well, really, there is somebody for everybody in this world.
Probably everyone's been asking you this, and we asked William Shatner yesterday about the experience of being directed by somebody that you have acted with
yeah.
for, what, 18 or 20 years,
yeah.
Being directed by Leonard Nimoy in this movie. How did it work for you?
Just horrible. Having put up with him during the series and our violent disagreements, when I heard that he was going to do it, I came apart. I really just came apart. No, really, no one was more thrilled to know that he was going to do that. And Leonard has contributed so much to this series in so many ways over the years. From, you see, Star Trek was a very difficult show for directors to direct the series. And directors would come in, fine directors that really needed help. And as a result of us having been with the series, you can imagine walking on a set that you've never been on in the first place is a very nervous situation. And then when you saw this situation that you had to work with in the bridge, and it was all cupped in, and it's like a courtroom trying to make entrances and exits and making that exciting and making it move. And the complexities of special effects that go along with this show makes it very difficult. And so he contributed. We helped directors, you know, by making suggestions, and they would take them. So he's had, you know, he was real ready for it. Plus his experiences, he's had directorial experience in stage and had done some television. Bright, articulate man. A very smart man. And I knew when he came aboard that he was going to do a tremendous job. And I've worked for a lot of directors, big directors in my day. I've been very fortunate. And I have never worked with a director who came aboard so prepared to know exactly what he was going to do and why he wanted to do it and how it was going to work. And whether I or Bill Shatner disagreed with him, he'd turn around and show Bill Shatner or me where we were wrong, that it had to be this way. So I was thrilled for him for the morning review in the Los Angeles Times, and I agree with him. It was marvelous casting. Wonderful.
Mr. Shatner also said that it was a, quote, accident that Mr. Nimoy touched you on the shoulder and said, remember, or touched you on the face and said, remember, at the end of the film, thereby giving Mr. Bennett an out for the sequel. Mm-hmm. Could you relate what your memories are of when you originally shot that scene from Star Trek II?
Well, this was to have been Leonard's final film, and I, you know, really felt as much that it would be. All indications when we started shooting that
this is
show,
number two now.
Number two was going to be the end of Leonard. But we had all had, for us, not particularly for Paramount, as I've said to someone earlier, that I have to give a lot of credit to Michael Eisner and Barry Diller for going with this show and going with it again after number one. So when we were doing number two, I think number one took, I don't think Paramount really knew how that affected us, that we walked around not really proud of that show. And it's, you know, you go in a market or any public place and somebody says, gee, I saw Star Trek, you know, the movie. And you, for the first time, you don't say, how did you like it? Because you kind of feel what they're going to say. And they said, geez, I was really disappointed in it, you know. And it was a bad feeling for us. Now, when we started, so I kind of understood what Leonard meant, you know, and by getting out. So when they started number two, Leonard began to gain confidence as that film went on. The spirit, the feeling was there with Nick Meyer directing. You can feel it when it's going well. It may not be everything that you hope the critics would say about it, but you can tell whether it feels right to you or not. And this show began to feel good to Leonard, and I knew it. I could tell the way his spirits were lifted. And I knew his death scene was coming up. So Leonard told me, this was Leonard's idea, it was not an accident. Leonard planned that, and he told me what he was going to do.
That was not scripted?
No, it was not scripted at that time, but it was injected. It was, but it was Leonard's idea to lay the mind meld on McCoy and say, remember. You know.
At that time, however, did he have in mind that that could be a stimulus or a gateway to a sequel?
I'm sure he did. I'm sure it left it open, I think, for Leonard both ways. We would have never known. They could have worked something else around the remember thing, you know. But it certainly left the gate open for Leonard to return. But it was, I would have to say, an emotional decision at that time.
Not logical?
Not logical. That's correct.
I have to ask you then, at that time, if you felt that that left the gateway open for an especially juicy part for you in the sequel as well.
I knew that if... I knew that some it was going to have to revolve somehow around McCoy, of course, you know. And it was a wait-and-see game of how they were going to treat it. And I thought it was very clever the way they treated it, the way they came up with it. There was, however, you're always a little bit shocked when you see a film. I'm always shocked when I see one. I can hardly look at it myself on screen. But it's difficult for an actor to sit and look at a film because you see they cut this, and you think, why did they cut that? You know, and so you say, wait a minute, I got to get back to the story, you know, or I'll never get the hang of this. That's what we're doing sitting there, you know. Christ, they cut the whole elevator scene. You know, why did they do that? Then you get to think about it and say, well, no, I know why they did that. But that's a disturbing element.
Do you think that your role as McCoy has in any way damaged your career? Now, it's made you internationally popular, perhaps, more than anything you've done. But do you think when parts come up, producers and directors say, oh, well, he's a good actor, but he's flying around in the Enterprise. People wouldn't accept him playing the fireman in a small town or something.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a mixed blessing. Fortunately, I'm a kind of a lazy actor, and I really don't have the drive that Bill or Leonard have, and maybe pushing my career the way I should. Maybe part of that is because that I have had, I don't know, maybe, it may not seem so to you, but when I look back over the almost 30 years that I've been in this business, I have about filled the cup with myself. I have had young acclaim at Paramount, and I fell on my ass, and I picked myself up, and came back, and did a lot of different things. I've done a lot of things, and things have, don't get me wrong, I have turned down a pilot in the last 2 months. I've turned down 2 television shows in the last 2 months, simply because it didn't appeal to me. It's something that I have done before, and that I did for money. And if I was not in a financial position today, I would grab that pilot and grab those parts to pay that rent, so that which I did for so many years, taking things and just saying, well, maybe I can make this thing work, you know, or do something with it. And it'd be just crap, you know, but you try to squeeze some good fragrance out of it and it wouldn't come. So I finally just said, well, look, you're pretty damn lucky to be on a phenomenal show like Star Trek, and I've had some experiences out of Star Trek, I think we all have as actors, that no other actors have really ever experienced. And it's not very often that you can do something that I'm as sure as I'm sitting here will go down in the history of television and motion pictures, that we in some way will be remembered years after we're gone. And there are not many, as you know, in this town, there are not many of situations that grant you that. So I turned my mind around and said, gee, I'm a lucky guy, a real lucky guy to be a part of this thing.
Well, can you cite any part that's come along in the past year or two that maybe you really did want because it was such a great part and your agent said, sorry, but they've got you too identified with Star Trek and they won't talk to you?
I came very close to doing the heavy on a Marlon Brando picture at Metro, and I'm trying to think of the name of it. Harry Dean Stanton got the role. It was a marvelous role. Jack Nicholson was in it.
Oh, the Missouri Breaks?
Missouri Breaks. I came very close to getting the Harry Dean Stanton thing, and very close. And it was finally decided that, I'm sure it was Star Trek that blew it out.
Can we expect to see what are your thoughts concerning Star Trek IV, and if we do have it, is it going to be the resurrection of the Enterprise?
Well, that seems a logical thing, doesn't it? I don't know, but I have signed an option for the fourth, but you must always remember it's Paramount's option, it's not mine. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether they would even... studios are very secretive about their plans. We seem to be the last ones to know what's going to happen, or even if they intend to use you or how. And then it goes through the negotiation situation and becomes very complicated. So I don't really know. I know that, as I said, it's their option. It's not mine.
Would you look forward to it? Would you welcome it? Or is it something that...
Again, it's a script. If they can hold on to what they've got going now and come forth with a good script while you become enthused, that's where it is, the written word.
How do you feel about the destruction of the Enterprise, per se? I mean, you've worked with that ship for 18 years now.
Well, it was an emotional blow, when you know, really, when we're looking up there and seeing that go. You just, when I saw it happen, I thought, I don't know, I had real mixed emotions about it. It was again, as Spock says, the logical thing to do. It was a wonderful remark. After all, that ship's 20 years old, you know. So I don't know. Mixed emotions. mixed emotions.
Do you have a feeling, as many of the fans do, that the Enterprise is one of the characters?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I think that feeling exists, and I think that's probably when the film is shown in theaters, such as it will be today, that when they see that, there'll be a,
Do you feel that this Star Trek III is more specifically directed to the group we call Trekkies, or people who have followed every little nuance of Star Trek, more than the other pictures have been? I've heard several people say, well, the Trekkies are going to really understand this, and so forth and so on, but, you know, maybe somebody else won't.
No, I think that this show, the one that we saw the other night,
yeah,
is what Star Trek really was about as a series. This is what we really wanted to do the first time. And it was a series that brought all of the so-called Trekkies in, which include my doctor, my lawyer, my nurses, everybody that I meet are either closet Trekkies or Trekkies, it seems like, from the market to the maitre d' in a restaurant to the driver who drove me here this morning. So I think that this show really should bring in new fans. Hopefully we'll pick up some people who haven't liked Star Trek before. That's what I'm hoping.
There are those already that are lauding this film at the expense of something like Indiana Jones, because mm-hmm. it is clean cut, to use that in the most general
yes.
term, and the violence is restrained to the
sure.
plot. How do you feel about the relative violence of other fantasy films going on around Star Trek?
I really don't like it. In fact, there's been too much. You see, I'm from the old school. I came in as a kid in this business on the tail end of the glamour era of Hollywood. And I have never enjoyed violence for violence's sake, even as the heavies that I played, you know. I mean, they're absolutely nothing compared to what takes place today. I disagree terribly with what's being shown to young people, however much they enjoy looking at this guy. I don't see how it can physically and emotionally, not maybe subconsciously, disturb someone. And I'm surprised that the Spielberg-Lucas team would release something such as this. I have such great respect for the both of them, they're marvelous filmmakers. And I haven't seen Indiana Jones. And I was shocked to read what I read about it. But I think that Star Trek, as a result, this is going to be a film that all of those kids that the parents are not going to let in to see Indiana Jones will be in to see Star Trek. And some of the parents always say, well, I'll take the kid, you know. And that's where I hope we hook the new people. I think the father and the mother would sit down and say, well, gee, I enjoyed that picture. That's what happened with the series, you know. People would approach me, doctors and lawyers in the market or something, and say, you know, something funny, so the kids got us to look at Star Trek. He says, now then, we're looking at it with them. So the whole family enjoyed it. That's a marvelous thing. But when you go to make a personal appearance at a Star Trek convention, you see them this high mm-hmm. to in their 80s that are there.
Because of the longevity of Star Trek generally, it must be dismaying sometimes when people approach you as if you are an old friend and you don't know who they are, of
as
course.
As an old man.
Well, I didn't say that.
Disheartening. No, but you know what is amazing? Sure, what is amazing is that these kids that grew up with us, you know, now are married. They went through school, college with us. That happens all the time. You go on a service station, a guy waits on you. He said, Jesus, he said, I was in high school with you. He said, I'm in college now. Then you meet them who are married, and their kids are coming up.
I've got to tell you about a waitress down here in the dining room who served breakfast a couple yesterday, the day, somewhere now. She said she was president of her high school Star Trek club, and that now she's still dedicated to the whole thing, and she and her husband are having a terrible fight over this picture because she wants to buy a ticket and go see it. And he says, you're not spending money on a ticket. You're waiting until it gets to television.
Oh, no.
And she says, I can't wait. And it's
oh,
just,
my God.
It's going to wreck their marriage.
Isn't that awful?
Isn't that awful? That's
really,
give her a ticket.
Really terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I ask you, was there any part of this particular movie, this Star Trek III, that made you particularly uncomfortable? Were there any scenes that you didn't enjoy playing? Or
the scenes that I was in that I was uncomfortable with. The only thing that threw me about it was in the beginning. There's a scene on the elevator with Kirk and McCoy, and McCoy is acting, behaving very strangely, which is really the first time you see McCoy.
Uh-huh.
And it was really a very good scene. And that threw me so when it wasn't there. I thought, where are they going to put it, you know? And they never did put it. But I think maybe they thought that it would take the surprise element off of seeing him behave in the manner in which I did, that it would have tipped off too many of the people that he's the guy that is broken in down below. So it was, again, Mr. Spock was very logical in cutting it out.
You've been associated with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy for so long now. Have you everyone changes, obviously, but have they changed over the years?
Leonard and I have. Bill hasn't. Bill is still the energetic guy jumping around with a great sense of humor, and Leonard is the same. I think they're really about the same, basically, you know, or at least they look that way to me in their behavior. I don't see any change, with the exception of Leonard and Bill. We all started out in pretty moderate circumstances, and Leonard and Bill are very rich now, and I'm not as rich as they are, so I look at them as if, boy, aren't they rich?
when they introduced the sun in Star Trek II, I thought, okay, this is the lifeboat to keep this afloat forever. You know, they got somebody who could turn into a new young sex symbol if they need two more generations to keep going. Was there any discussion about that before they decided to kill him off in this, that maybe we need a new young sex symbol?
I think the studio had, I think that had been discussed, and rightfully so. And I think they were really feeling their way around with a number of people in that show. And it's just my feeling. I've not discussed it with them, you know. And I think that they were, you know, thinking of Savick at that time to move on, go with it. Maybe in the beginning, the son, the boy, Merritt, was originally thought to be, maybe he could someday be Captain Kirk. So it's quite possible, and I assume that they will continue to fuss around with it and to bring, you know, new blood into it.
Because so many shows have the older, wiser, whoever, and then the young, hot-headed, sexy somebody.
Like T.J. Hooker.
Yeah, right.
Dee, could you tell us, could you contrast the style of directing that Leonard had versus Bob Wise and Nick Meyer in the three movies? Is the style of the director influenced the movie particularly, or was it different to work with the different ones?
Yeah, well, Bob Wise was so involved in mechanics and special effects, you just have no idea what a complicated show that number one was. It was a tremendous, well, you know, the thing cost, what, around $40 or $50 million, and these sets were immense. The electrical problems went on and on and on. We'd sit for a day and wait for a page of dialogue, you know, to come in. So those kind of complications and the special effects were all screwed up. The first 3 or 4 months of what were absolutely shoddy had to do. It's a wonder the man kept his sanity. And it's only because Robert Wise is such a professional that he could. I look at him in great admiration for the calmness that he exuded during that period. I could have never done it in my life. Leonard, being an actor, you can imagine, it's the first time for Leonard, I think, maybe to stand back and see us, which is a unique experience. And I'm sure that all actors would look at one and say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. I would have done it this way. But you never tell him that. You naturally, you don't go and tell him that. this way that gave Leonard an opportunity to perhaps bring out a touch somewhere here and there that he would like for you to do. And that's the advantage of having worked with Leonard. But as I said before, he knows the actor's problems and he knows our problems and understands them better than anyone in the world. So two different things entirely, wise. McMeyer was a delightful guy to work with, and but in the beginning, Nick was terribly confused with the show. You know, but as time went on, he smoothed out and rolled along terrifically. It's I don't know. Every director seems to have a certain style about it, the way he does things.
What can you tell us about the seeming absence of Gene Roddenberry? Any inside stuff there that you could relate to us about his absence?
No, no more than has been quoted and said earlier before. Gene has still simply remained in a consultant basis.
Was he on the set at all for Three?
He came on several times, but he was not there for any other reason than to, usually he was with someone, he would come on and bring somebody on the set, or he was on a number of times and came over by himself to look to see how things were going. And on a consultant basis, my understanding continues to send in suggestions to Harve Bennett and Leonard of how he felt about this scene or that scene. But It's a rather strange feeling because Gene was with us so solidly during the series, and it's a weird feeling to know that he is not as involved as he once was with the show.
I mean, I'm just wondering if you find that to be a rather sad thing. Or
I think it is to me because, after all, Gene is the godfather of this whole situation, and without Gene Roddenberry, none of us would be here today. And he's had such a great influence on Molly. I've known Gene since 1960s when I first worked for him. I did a series for him in San Francisco about a criminal lawyer that he wrote. So I've known Gene a long time. And so it's particularly heartbreaking for me.
Why did he choose to step back, or did he choose to step back?
Yeah, he had worked awfully, awfully hard on that when they were getting that number one thing together, and he just about worked himself into a hospital. Because that number one was enough to put anybody in the hospital, and almost put all of us in. And I think that he saw that, and he was working night and day, and he had worked night and day on the series, and then he had continually stayed with Star Trek and the fans, and he was continually trying to get it going again, you know, until I think it just drove Gene a little bit mad, you know, and the doctor said, look, cool it, or you're going to be a sick man, and I think that's exactly what he's done, back off.
You hear stories from actors about the part they either turned down and it became the longest running series around, practically, that they almost turned down. Did you have any reservations about the Star Trek series? Did you nearly turn it down by chance?
No, they turned me down. Huh. See, they made the first pilot with Jeffrey Hunter, and Roddenberry had used me in two pilots. And the way I met Gene Roddenberry because I was playing heavies. And I had done the lead heavy in three pilot films, one of which was Rawhide with Clint Eastwood. And a guy named Bob Sparks at Columbia and Bill Dozier were there then, as you well know, produced them. And they decided, well, we'll do a series with D, because all three of those pilots sold. So Gene happened to be the guy that wrote the pilot, and that's how I met him. And unfortunately, it didn't sell. So Gene wanted me, to get back to your question, for the first pilot. And somebody at the network didn't want me. And again, the feeling was that it was because I was playing all these heavies that I wasn't right for the doctors. So then they made a second pilot of Star Trek with Bill Shatner. And while Bill was doing that pilot, I was doing another for Gene called Police Story. And Police Story, they put in abeyance, and I had signed a contract for that. And then when NBC saw Police Story, and they saw me in another part, they said, "We want him for The Doctor." So I signed two contracts. I was signed to do Police Story and Star Trek at the same time. I had an alternating contract. A Police Story didn't go. So I went in the very first episode, but I was not in either pilot.
What happened to the Jeffrey Hunter system?
And did something about it. That we were just on the second year of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry and Greg, I can't think of his last name, our production man, the three of us sat and had lunch together and talked about, wonder if we could talk Paramount into making a motion picture of Star Trek on our layoff. Had we done it, God knows, you know, what would have happened, see. But couldn't get it off the ground. So Lucas was just wise enough to move in and take the cake and run with it. But we were the beginners.
What was so difficult about that first Star Trek movie? Why did it get to such a... I mean, obviously the special effects were difficult, but
yeah.
Why were they difficult as opposed to two
we
and three?
We were on the V'ger set. I've forgotten how many thousands of lights were involved in it, and all this thing sat 8 feet off of the ground, and they had a whole crew underneath where these lights would work this way. Where is something you'd have to be there to see. Really, it was unreal what was going on. If one light bulb blew, you know, I wrecked the scene, and people were stepping through these glass plates, you know, that we had to walk from one, they were like squares, and you'd step from the wooden square over the glass. And a couple of crew members fell through that. Bill Shatner went through one and caught himself. It was 8 feet down. Just all kind, and the company that Paramount engaged in the beginning to do the beaming in, beaming out, all the special effects, it turned out that it was all just bad stuff. They couldn't use it. And the story, they had trouble with the story from the very beginning. That's why we'd sit and wait for a page of dialogue to come in, you know. They lost sight of the fact that Star Trek, again, involves human beings and people. They concentrated too damn much on production, and I would have loved to have seen them do A City on the Edge Forever for the first picture. A very simple film with very few special effects in it, but something concerning the people. That's what it's all about.
Alan Reitman said that he showed Ghostbusters to several audiences without the special effects to see if the people story would carry through.
There you go.
Do you think that, for instance, this most recent Star Trek picture could hold an audience attention if you showed it without the special effects?
I believe it could. I don't, naturally, you know, we have a whole generation out there now that just love, you know, the special effects, and so much of the appeal is there. But if they had shot it in the beginning and said, look, there are going to be no special effects, then I think we could have worked it.
I love the tantalizing glimpses over the years we've had of what medicine might be like in the 23rd century. I'm wondering if there's ever been more interest in developing what a surgeon might do at that, you know, the Marcus Welby of 23. Has there ever been any development like that discussed with you to enhance that sort of thing?
No, I know that when we were doing the series, we were getting into that facet of it, because Gene used to go up to Edwards and we'd find out what they were doing, and I went up there with him several times, and we'd see what they were doing, and then Gene would try to project beyond that by about 50 years. And it was amazing. The tricorder, for instance, the flight physician there at Edwards placed a tricorder about the size of this unit here on the test pilot. And when he would test a ship, it registered his heartbeat, his blood pressure, pulse, mm-hmm. the whole thing. They were doing what we were doing in Star Trek already, so we'd have to go beyond it, you know.
That was my next question, so, if there were so examples.
So much that you see today, when you walk into an intensive care unit today, it looks just like McCoy's sick bay unit with all the apparatus. When we did that first, people said, my God, look, you can see the heart, and the pulse, and the blood pressure, but today it's all there. So if they got into... Of course, I haven't done any serious surgery since I operated on Spock's father and gave him that green blood transfusion. So I'm a little bit out of practice. I've been spending all my time on the bridge lately, and there's too much trauma going on.
Was the other night the first night that you'd seen?
Yeah, it was the first time I'd seen it.
Kind of a, what was your reaction? The crowd seemed to be very into it. They were dedicated Trek fans. But how does that affect you? And you can see their reactions right there when you, it's like you're almost on a stage there, they're reacting to you.
Oh, you mean the audience?
Right.
The audience.
The audience reaction.
Yes, I love it. That's one thing I love about Star Trek. Mm-hmm. They're very vocal about it. And that's why it's fun to see it in a theater. You know, I think instead of the studio screen, I didn't go to the studio screen. It's because of that. I wanted to be in an audience where, and that audience wasn't the complete one that's going to go to the Cinerama Dome and will be in there today. Those are the fun screenings to see. They really get wild, you know. It's just crazy, and it makes it part of the fun.
Have you gotten some fan letters from astronauts and so forth? Do you know how many of those are dedicated Trekkies?
Practically all of them. I have, they all sent me, they all asked for autographed pictures, you know, NASA did, you know, when we were doing the series, yeah. And we exchanged pictures. I have... Mm-hmm. I have a set of pictures at home of the all of the original group of astronauts signed, you know, from the very beginning. And they used to run it on the big screen in Houston every Thursday night when we're on. And almost every time I go to a Star Trek convention to a personal appearance, we have someone with NASA with us. Because NASA knows that Star Trek has captured the youth of the country, so they go along and have an astronaut or someone from NASA to speak to them and run NASA films and that sort of thing. And a lot of young people have become involved in NASA and interested in it as a result of Star Trek. A lot of doctors. I get letters, you know, I've gotten maybe in my life, I guess, maybe 50 or 60 letters that guys have written me, and they're becoming doctors because of McCoy. They grew up with him. And it inspired them. And,
Well, do you, I don't imagine you in the situation Dick Chamberlain used to be in, or Robert Young or somebody, where people really thought they were real doctors and right, and say, take out my tonsils, deliver my baby, or what is the nature of my disease?
Or speak at a medical convention or something.
No, I got a lot of mail that says that they wished that I was their doctor. It seems, what is interesting about this mail, I get that constantly. McCoy's compassion for the people that he's working with and the one-on-one kind of thing, that the people in this country do not have a good rapport with their physician.
Oh, I do. Mine even makes house calls.
Well, you're lucky. Very few of us do that. You know?
You would have to make planet calls, I guess.
But generally speaking, that's very true. You know, you go in and a lot of people need somebody. Sometimes it's just as good to confide in someone. And simply by a doctor talking to somebody in the right manner, he can do an awful lot for a patient. And that hardly exists today. Too many is get them in and get them out. I think it's very sad, really.
Forgive me for this question, lest it be something that you're tired of hearing, but I'm going to ask you anyway if there is such a thing as a Star Trek philosophy.
Yeah,
we've asked it of other people. And
Bill did?
Well, he said he detected a little hostility in the question. It wasn't intended.
Oh, I see. Well, he's getting sensitive in his old age.
He gave us the T.J. Hooker philosophy.
Oh, well, he's, see? Yeah. Maybe he's a little tougher now. I told him I'd rather be called Captain Kirk than Hooker. You know, I'd rather have somebody say, hey, Bones, and then, hey, Hooker.
But what is it that you think of as the philosophical thrust of Star Trek, if there is one?
Gee, it's such a complex question. It is a complex question. You wonder, you know, there's so many things. I don't know. I think that the young people for the last few generations have been brought up in a very negative atmosphere. And that perhaps Star Trek had a very positive approach. And when it started, we started with the hippie generation, you remember. The beatniks. These kids didn't know where they were going. You know, you saw them on the highway with their dog and their floppy hats, and to hell with it, let the world go by. What's left? You know, we're all going to be blown up. And we still are feeling that way today. And Star Trek, I think, gave them hope. And it gave them an outlook of there is somewhere to go. And as corny as it sounds, there are new frontiers that haven't been touched yet. And I think it raised an excitement within them, as well as they were seeing a group of people who were adults, real human beings, who really cared for each other and cared for their fellow man to a great degree. And I think all of these morals and these qualities were embodied in the show, besides the show leaving some kind of a message in each episode as quietly as it did. I think these are perhaps a few things that have been meaningful, certainly to the youth of this country. They are certainly inspired. As Leonard has said, that there are a lot of people entering into the science field as a result of Spock. See, that's when the young mind is so open and ready to be saturated. We could all be speaking a third or fourth language if we had started young enough. And that when they see this, it's an inspiration to them.
Some of this seems so clearly delineated in 3, when all of you turn outlaw for a while, when that's what you have to do to go get Spock.
Yes,
the brotherly bond is stronger than ultimately the military one.
Right. Yes, I thought that that underlying thought there again is the caring for each other, that at the sacrifice of, as Kirk says, you know, you'll never live to see that commendation that I'm giving you.
Yeah. Well, it's when Robin Hood turns outlaw that he becomes so memorable,
right.
And when your crew turns outlaw, I think that's a special bonus in the film.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think it's, I think they're going to get a tremendous kick out of this show.
Off the series, have the three of you, or the group of you, the cast, remained friendly? Are you friends with Leonard Nimoy and Bill Shatner?
I don't see so much of Bill. I don't see Bill except at some function that we are occasionally called together with. I see Leonard periodically, and I see quite a bit of Leonard. I see more of Leonard than I do anyone in the cast. I talk to Jimmy and Walter by telephone a great deal. George, I don't talk to him too often. I did an 8-city tour with him for Toys of Us 1 year. But he's been so busy trying to run the city with Mayor Bradley that I never see him. And Walter, I talk to by telephone occasionally. But on a social basis, no. Leonard's the only one that I've seen on a social basis.
How did that come to be? I suppose the reason anybody becomes friends, but...
I don't know. We I don't know. I have a very special feeling for Leonard, and I have a reason to believe Leonard has it for me, and I feel very strongly about him, like a brother almost, and it's just one of those things that our relationship turned out that way.
At the screening, there were 6 of the main 7 there. Nichelle Nichols is in Kansas City. How often does it occur where all 7 of the main crew will be together at one place and one time?
Very, very seldom. Usually it's at a theater wrap party or some event that Paramount might be holding for theater owners of that sort, where we would all be together. But it's very rare to see them, that many of us all together.
Has it ever happened at one of the conventions?
We had a convention in New York where I believe almost, do you remember, Ellen, was it New York or Chicago? It was in Chicago, where there were 15 or 20,000 people there. And I think practically all of us were in Chicago, I'm not sure. I know Leonard and Bill were there. Nichelle, I believe, was there. I think almost all of us were there, but perhaps the only time. More were there in Chicago together than had ever been anywhere else.
You met your wife at the Long Beach Little Theater, or whatever it was. Does she still act, or does she say to you, I want a little role in the next Star Trek?
No, not at all. No, she was. I met her in a play, yes, she was. And when I signed at Paramount, Carolyn was a very beautiful young girl, and she was quite a good actress too. Paramount wanted to sign her, but she didn't want it. She thought that one of us would be enough, and she has never had any interest. She's a very severe and good critic, and a great judge of talent. I'm always saying, she says she'll watch somebody on television, and she'll say, I like that guy. I think he's going to make it. And by God, he does. I can't tell you, or the girl, everybody she picks. She's never put me in her stable. I'm always saying, God, I'd love to make it with you. You know, with that kid about that. So we came home the other night. She said, Dee, she said, I think I'm going to sign you. I said, yeah, now that I'm this old, I said, you're going to put me in your stable. After she saw the movie, she thought she'd sign me up.
We know that Walter Koenig likes to write, and that William Shatner likes to breed horses and that sort of thing. What is your favorite extracurricular pursuit, if that's the adjective?
Well, it's been sitting on my ass, really.
Fair enough.
No, not really. I don't know. I am really, as I said earlier, I'm a very lazy guy, basically, I guess. I can enjoy doing an awful lot of nothing. I mean that by bumming, but I don't know. I do go horseback riding occasionally. I, you know, try to learn to just sit on one every now and then. I used to do some painting, which I haven't done in years. I don't do that. I sound like Ira Reiner, I believe it was, and they said, what are your hobbies? He said, I have none.
Is there anyone who has followed the adventures of the Star Trek decades now who might be the official chronicler or historian of all of this? Will this complete story come out between covers someday? Is there an historian attached to this ongoing project?
You mean who would it be?
Yeah, I know there have been diaries published about, say, Star Trek One.
You mean for the overall situation? Mm-hmm. Gee, I really wouldn't know. I ordinarily would say Gene Roddenberry would do something like that. You know, somewhere down the line.
As it is, I'm wondering if you've ever been interviewed by people writing dissertations or master's theses on Star Trek.
Oh, yes. A lot of university students write and tell me they're doing their theses and for their master's. And there's a University of Nebraska, somewhere in Nebraska in the Middle West, have a Star Trek accredited course with Spock and Kirk and McCoy, the three characters. I heard this on ABC radio about 3 years ago. There was quite a big thing about it. But many students do a thesis on Star Trek.
How does that strike you personally? Are you somewhat bemused by that?
Yeah, it's all, you know, it's... The thing that strikes me most is that it doesn't stop. Even if the movies stop, it never stopped when we went off the air, see. It's continued. And it showed that it would have continued even if we'd never done another movie. And, Yeah, it's kind of a weird feeling, you know. You look at all of this, and that's just one of the many things, you know, that seemingly has taken place in our lives with this experience.
Do you think that Star Trek was blessed by the fact that the TV series was canceled in 3 years? Because any series that goes on and on and on, be it MASH or Gunsmoke or whatever, finally, writers write themselves out and quality declines, I think.
Mm.
And you think the very fact that the series only lasted 3 years is one thing that's kept the cult alive?
That's a difficult question to know, but I see what you're saying. And one way it's true. It's always like that. I always leave them wanting a little more. I'll never forget. This has nothing to do with what we're all here for, but that reminds me of a story. Years ago, I was driving to George Reeves, driving to Denver, Colorado. We were going there to be separated. We were in the Air Force. So we drove there. And it was an awful long trip, and it was during the period where you could not get a hotel room because there were servicemen everywhere and everything was filled. We were very tired and sleepy. And George, of course, had been under contract before the service, and he was quite well known. And then he had been in that big service show they had. I don't know, that was a great big extravaganza, where the theme was, we're all little lambs lost in the woods, or whatever the hell it was. Anyhow, we drive into Reno, Nevada, dog tired, and we go into this bar, have a drink, thinking that we might be able to get a room there. And as we walk into the bar, the band struck up this theme. They recognized Joy. And we stood there, and we were having this drink, and I said, George, we're in. We've got to get a room here tonight. And it was all like the drinks were on the house and the whole thing. So we had a second drink, and I said, when are you going to ask about the room? He said, I think it's time to get out of here. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, come on, let's go. I said, you got to be kidding, George. He said, no, let's go, D. So out we walked, and I said, what the hell's wrong with you? He said, you always want to leave them wanting a little more. Here we are, so damn tired.
You wanted more sleep.
Yeah, and you know where we ended up? This true story. Pulled out. He was a terribly fast driver. And we, you know, we were in uniforms, but we had neckerchiefs on. It was cold, you know. And a cop caught us for speeding outside of Reno, pulled us over. And boy, he was hot, because George was doing something like 85 or 90 miles an hour at it. And he saw us, and he said, oh, for God's sakes, I didn't know you were servicemen. He said, those neckerchiefs, he said, fool me. And George said, by the way, he said, do you know where we can get a place to stay tonight?
I bet he did.
And that's where we stayed. That's where we could have been in this wonderful hotel in Reno, but George, the actor, wanted to leave him wanting more.